You have a good lunch?
Yes.
I ate too much, but any little insights or surprises from your lunch discussion? Opening our heart to pain, what are your coping mechanisms for that? Thank you very much. Great. Thank you. Nothing happening? Okay. Yes, please. Go for it.
With my group, we were talking about self-compassion and where does self-compassion goes to where it becomes selfishness.
Uh-huh.
So where would be that line? So that's one of the things that with the conversation we came up with that.
Yep, yep.
Some of us have a hard time setting the line.
Yeah, so we were talking about self-care and self-compassion. And just to bring us along, bless you, from this morning, thank you very much, because that's what we're going to go into a bit, is also we were just talking about the benefits of compassion, which I think are somewhat obvious. Another one I didn't mention is oxytocin. It actually, the warm feeling you get from our own compassion actually releases the hormone oxytocin, which is the same that's released by lactating mothers. So, I mean, it has a physiological effect on your body, a positive physiological effect on your body. So we hear all of these things, and it's just a bit of, why am I not spending more time cultivating the compassionate, awakened heart like that? And it's always a nice thing. One thing I didn't mention this morning I want to talk about now is intention and dedication. Intention and dedication. So we set an intention at the beginning of this morning, the beginning of the class. Anytime during the day, you can reestablish that intention. And the intention is a bit of a spark for your motivation. Motivation is a little bit of the action of, this is what I'm going to do now. Or I'm motivated to get something to eat, but my intention is to nourish myself and be healthy and things like that. And part of my motivation is, well, I need to eat something. So intention becomes that spark. In Buddhism, we have an intention or motivation, and often they're mixed or interchanged at the beginning of any activity, and we have a dedication at the end of any activity like that. So, and there are bookends around our projects, around our days, around our activities that tend to make the activities more virtuous. That. So this is a perfect time now we come back. Just close your eyes for a moment. Check your intention again. Check your intention. And take a moment to just reestablish, again, this positive intention for the rest of the afternoon. And again, all the activities of the rest of your day. Please relax. So reestablishing your motivation can be done really more quickly. It can be done in a car. It can, you know, you have a snit with somebody. You said the wrong thing to somebody, right? And just you can go back to your cubicle at work or go take yourself. I've taken myself many times into the bathroom to resort. You know, things are not going well during the day, something's happened, and you have no space, no private space. Well, you have the bathroom. You know, nobody's going to follow you in there. That's your private space. One time I was, when my sister lived in Brooklyn, New York, for many years, she doesn't live there anymore, but she had a third floor walk-up apartment, two kids, her husband, and maybe my brother and I would be visiting, and maybe my brother would be visiting with his two kids. So it was two bedrooms, and there was like a guest bed in a kind of work room that doubled as the cat's litter box and a studio. Like, you get the idea. There wasn't a lot of room. Little living room. Wasn't a lot of space. So I was a practicing Buddhist at the time. I would fly in from California. And it was really intense for me. I lived in a little cabin in the Redwoods. I worked with other people, but I lived by myself. And this was a bit much. So I would go into the bathroom and, like, check my motivation. You know, what's happening right now? Or I just breathe. I didn't have to go to the bathroom sometimes. I would just kind of have a little moment. You can always do that. And it recenters you. And then that gives you perspective to come out of the bathroom and operate from. So it's very, very important. Most of you in this tradition that have been coming here have heard about intention, motivation for a long time, and you're aware of that. At the other end of the day is dedication. You're going to invest all the positive energy you've created, and we'll do a dedication at the end today to helping us in our tradition move along a path to full awakening, becoming a Buddha, a fully awakened being, as then you're unlimited in helping all others. So the real point of what we're doing in our tradition is to benefit all other beings. And you can certainly do it more with this fully awakened, opened heart, like that. So let me talk about some obstacles, and then we're going to get into the self-compassion. How do we draw the line? It was a great comment that you had. When is it self-care, self-compassion, and when is it... So one thing I would say just directly to that first is I think most of you are pretty honest with yourself and have some degree of limitations, and you know when you've kind of gone too far in this direction or that direction. So for me, when I, let's say I was running a center, having a break could actually be very beneficial. But it might have been a break of a day off or something like that, not like a break, you know, it's June and I'm taking the rest of the year off. Forget everybody else. That ends up being, you know, an extreme where you go into the selfishness. This is what I need right now. I don't care about anyone else. Or is it actually I do need a break, taking a week's holiday because I'm melting down with everybody. I can't possibly process anything positive anymore that's going on at work or in my family. You know, so those are just some practical levels that I think, would you say most of you have some idea where the line is? To some degree, you're probably somewhat aware whether it's too indulgent or not. I did have people tell me when I was working at centers, because I tend to be a little all or nothing kind of workaholic. And so the staff, who were very kind at Vajrapani, they were amazing, and they would you know, they're very close friends of mine, most of them still close friends, and they would come and kind of say, like, one of the close friends would say, you need a break, you know, you really need, and I'd be like, no, I'm fine, you need, and then they'd like take my two arms, Amy, you need a break, and then I'd be like, okay, now I'm hearing you, like it. So there are times when we as the friend may be playing some tough love of, you know what, and sometimes I've even placed my hand on somebody gently, you know what, it's time to stop right now. Like, you need to go home. It's, okay, are you hearing me? Look at me for a moment. You need to stop today. It's enough. So there are times when people are trying to give us kind messages, our friends, our coworkers. I think it's really important, like that. And then there's times when we're, and don't you feel it here when you're overindulging and you know it's just a little bit much? You know, how many spa treatments did you need last week? Was the massage alone not enough? You know, I mean, so there's certain ways we do take care of ourselves, think it's smart, and then you're kind of a little bit too much. You know, some people do it through shopping. I know somebody I know is a big shopper, and it's a way of treating herself. So she gets one thing, but then one thing was too much, and then it created a fight with her husband, how much money she spent with, you know, so there's different ways. So we are going to talk a little bit more about what self-care is, what self-compassion is versus that hopefully will clarify. I want to just talk about loneliness a little bit because this is a big obstacle in here, and this is what creates fear. This is part of our sadness, fear, that can then lead to resentment and anger, the pain. A lot of people have the pain of loneliness, very common. We do silly things out of not wanting to be lonely sometimes. I know people that have gotten married, and really when you check the motivation, it's all about not wanting to be lonely. Not really a great way to get married. It's one thing to feel as whole as you can be, as together as you can be, and want to engage and have a relationship from there, because most probably you're going to attract somebody more together then, because we tend to mirror people as well, as your relationships do. Okay. Overcoming loneliness by connecting in positive ways. Somehow I wondered why I capped these words in here. I'm like, doesn't have any meaning capped. Some reason. Okay. But basically, compassion clearly contributes to better relationships. The more you can positively connect with people, you tend to not be lonely, because there's going to be people that are also coming to you because you're friendly and you're warm and you're genuine. You're authentic. Okay. And people understand that. Also, are you there when people are down? It's not just about I'm around people because they make me feel good. It's people, we're also here to serve. In our tradition, we're here to serve others, to help others. So you find out that somebody is a little bit down and I show up and mention the way I would show up this morning to help. So as a result of that, that kindness is only going to come back to you multifold. Basically. And so when I'm down, I would feel I'm having surgery or something's going on. I would feel that it would be okay to ask a couple of people because I help them. I wouldn't have a problem so much. It can be scary to ask, but I know if I've already offered, and I'm not necessarily offering with an intention that I hope they'll be there for me. It's more the kindness. But then when I do need help, that connection makes me more available to say I need help. It's okay to ask for help. You know, and then the tendency is the person wants to give back because, so there, then you create healthy relationship. Then you create healthy relationship. That's again how the world goes around more harmoniously. And it's been shown also to strengthen the immune system, those healthy connections. There's scientific research. So kindness as a key factor in forming and maintaining social relationships helps keep you healthy. Helps keep you healthy. In romantic relationships, it makes you more attractive. Did you ever see that with people when you're when you were on the merry-go-round? Do you remember those days? Dating? Or whatever we were doing? I can't even remember. It's been so long, right? But that whole scene, right? I had a lot of relationships before I was a nun. And there's a thing, so there were people I knew that postured themselves. This is maybe, I'm going to go way back to my 20s. We used to call it a game. It was a game. And you'd even have this, remember this term that you'd play hard to get? I think I learned it from my mother, that girls should play hard to get, because you certainly didn't want to be easy. Oh my, right? Okay, you didn't want to be easy in the term of what easy meant. It meant possibly loose, and maybe we'll go into what's the word I'm looking for? Promiscuous? Promiscuous, okay. And that wasn't a good thing. That meant you were having a lot of sex early and maybe not healthily. Okay. So there were some days that wasn't okay. I think it's probably still not so okay today. But so what I noticed is there were people I would meet at parties, university, high school and university, and then I'd notice how they'd have a real edge on, like their... So, and it wasn't all that attractive, especially if they were rude to people, angry. It wasn't very attractive. Kindness got my attention. Kindness really gets my attention now. Now, there can be early days in relationships where people go through some passages where they tend to, I did this for a while, you tend to connect in for destructive relationships. You're experimenting, you're exploring. I don't think it's done as much these days to a degree. I don't know. But I went through this passage, so when I did see somebody kind of mirroring that kind of aspect, I found it attractive. Okay, that was a great sense of my misknowing, K-N-O-W. Real confusion for me. So I think as I get healthier, I find when I see kindness, you know, and it can be some little wrinkled up gnome on the corner, I find it incredibly attractive. Yeah. And notice when you see an act of kindness, you can even do this in a minor reflection, but you see an act of kindness, notice how you respond. Anybody reflect? How do you respond? When was the last time you saw somebody helping somebody? Somebody untangling a dog from a leash that's tacked up, somebody picking something up for somebody off the floor, somebody holding a door for an elderly person, helping, you know, do you see little things like that? Somebody helping somebody in a parking lot or letting somebody go in front of them. What's your response to it? How do you respond generally?
I smile. I want to see the person more.
Yeah.
I want to thank them sometimes.
Yeah, generally there's a smile. There's a, you know, normally you're not like, you know, what do you do that for? We might do that when we're younger. That may come up. But generally, so it makes you feel good. You see this kind of stuff. That's your good health. Keeps you from loneliness is that connection. And it's great to thank people. It's great to make, you know, there was somebody in New York. I mean, New York, there's bazillion ways to practice. Sometimes I'm just like, oh my gosh. I mean, there's street people and there's people all over the subway and there's so many opportunities to help people. Just up and down the subway steps. There's so many people you're trying to navigate. So easy to kind of, and New Yorkers, you know, we have a thing about New Yorkers. I think the world kind of says New Yorkers and people go, oh, you know, I find them extremely kind. There's a lot of them living on this little island. It's a lot of them packed in there, packed up, right? It's all very dense. And I think, I mean, they're very in your face, just their nature. It's part of their culture. They're very in your face. So I grew up in Philadelphia. Philadelphians are very in your face, okay? So for me, it's a familiar culture. That doesn't bother me. And in that, I find them very kind. They may be in your business, maybe too much so. It's part of their thing from living densely populated like Indians. Very similar. Indians are very much in your business, okay? But the density thing, but they will, I mean, I had so many experiences the last week of just in the store, and people come in, oh, can we help you with something? This is New York. All the time for me. In every shop I went, every market, on the subway, where are you going? Genuinely, can I help you? You know, oh, no, you want to get off at the next stop and then take the steps up and exit on the right side. Many times people helping me. You know, I had somebody stop me from crossing the street because a car was, somebody grabbed me. So kind. You know, so I find them very, very kind. They have to maneuver. They have to be somewhat kind to make it work there, the way for them to get through their space. So all those kind of acts, I would just keep reaching out and trying to reach in here to find that, to reach back out from that place, because that will eradicate loneliness in your life. There's always people you can practice connection with. There's some that push you away, but there's a vast amount of people that are there reaching back. So it definitely fights loneliness. I know that, let me read this one thing. And so the other thing about University of Chicago did a study that found that extreme loneliness is a huge cause of death in the elderly and can shorten their life by a large amount. And that's very difficult. You know, shut-ins and people that don't have anyone to connect with contributes also to high blood pressure, obesity, things like that. So it's something to think about. A greater 14% greater risk of dying in the elderly, those who are reported being lonely like that. And some studies, it says here, suggest extreme loneliness is more dangerous than cigarette smoking. So it does have quite an effect on you. The opposite is connection. And how do we do it? You know, how do we do it? So just picking on Maureen from a little conversation we had at lunch. So in a sense, loneliness is a kind of pain, in a sense, in your social body. Some scientists call it your social body. Think about that. Okay? And it needs to be remedied if you want to live a healthy life. So you take care of your physical body. A lot of people do. Going to the doctor, making sure, oh, I need a knee replacement, I need this, I'm going to do this. I go and get my teeth cleaned. What about your social body? Meaning, am I connecting? How am I engaging with people? And I noticed at the centers, when I was running a center, and this is so important, do you ever rejoice at the good things that you do in life? You know, at the positive qualities that you have? Does anybody here take some time and really appreciate yourself? Thank you, back there. She's nodding. Thank you very much. That's part of the self-care. Okay, so the rest of you said no or didn't respond. That's your work. That's your practice. Seriously, I'm not talking about an egomaniacal sense. I'm talking about, you know, you recognize at least once each day, I'm okay. I'm a good person.
When I wake up in the morning, that's how I feel.
Great. That's what I do. That's what I do.
A lot of people
did not wake up this morning. That's right. So having some reflection on death and impermanence. But I do it in the morning. And while I'm lying in bed, I have a moment. I wake up and I'm in this body again, in this life, and I'm like, amazing. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you to all the beings before me that took my mind to get it to where it is right now, to get me into this life right now. That's my Buddhist belief. So I have this gratitude, really appreciating my good qualities and the good things I'm able to do, you know, and then I think, like, this could be ending any moment. This could be ending any moment. So I want to use the day wisely, and I set my motivation, and that's like my first waking 2 minutes is that. Doesn't have to take long, but some appreciation. It's really valuable for you. It's valuable for your social body. For your social body. Why? Because then when I engage with others, I feel good about myself. So I'm presenting possibly a more positive face to you. You know people that feel good about themselves and people that don't. And the people that don't, it's awkward sometimes to be around them. You tend to not want to be around them. Okay? But when I'm feeling, hey, I can contribute, I can help, I'm listening to you, I'm present, I'm here and I'm okay, you're more willing to make a connection with the person. It's very important, those kind of things. Yes.
Thank you. My daughter is an introvert and I'm an extreme extrovert, and I've learned over the years more about introverts. However, do you have any comments about loneliness and introverts when you were saying your social body reaching out? I mean, they may not care to do that. Have you?
So there's a misconception about, I think, about introverts and extroverts. And so I'm not quite sure which I am anymore. I used to always think I was an extrovert. But introverts, technically, I think there's a definition. Please correct me if I'm wrong, because some of you may know more about this. My understanding is it's where you renew yourself, how you renew yourself. Introverts do it, prefer to be on their own to renew themselves. Separate, you know, recreational activity on their own. Retreat. Quiet time. Doing something by themselves, which is what I tend to do to renew myself. Even though I can be totally out there with a lot of people. And extroverts tend to want to renew around others and be with others to do that. So it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with loneliness. I think extroverts, when they see introverts wanting to be on their own, it may just trigger a bit of loneliness in the extrovert to think, oh, why do you want to do that? You're going to go out for a walk by yourself? Well, I'm available. You don't want to go with me. Like, so that just sometimes hits a little place in us that, you know, it's something to look at. It's just something to look at. It's not saying you're wrong or you're bad. It's just, I'll look at that every time I get a little thorn and I go, oh, you know, they're being mean to somebody or they're not including me, or then I just look at that. But my understanding, is that correct about introverts, extroverts? So I think no problem. It's good that you recognize that in each other so that you just know, like if she's like, Mom, I just need to be alone right now, I want to do it, and you go, cool, that's how she recharges. Let her recharge that way. And you go, okay, great, I'm going to call a couple friends and we're going out and we're going to, you know, if you want to join us, call me, text me later. And then you can, you know, because she needs her time and you're going to get your time with socially. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I learned that the hard way.
Do you think you feel lonely or you think she's lonely?
I don't think she's lonely. I think she knows how to take care of herself that way. I was just wondering when you were talking about loneliness, whether it's a different idea when you talk to an introvert or an extrovert. Sounds like not.
No, I don't think it's different.
Yeah.
For an introvert or extrovert. I don't really think so. Because I think the loneliness is just... And you could have it as an introvert as well if you're feeling very disconnected from yourself. So that could be one slight difference. But I think extroverted people also being disconnected from themselves, meaning their own needs and their own fears and not looking at their pain, is the same type of experience. Karen?
And people can feel lonely. Wait for the mic.
At least I believe this is true. There's lots of lonely people who are in a crowd, but yet they still feel lonely. They still feel like they don't belong. They're not loved. They're not part of it. So.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I've had that experience many times. You know, you're around all these people, and you're like, I don't belong here. I don't fit in or anything. Absolutely. Sometimes that can contribute to more. Some people are very... So there's loneliness. Let me just qualify. There's loneliness and there's aloneness. Aloneness is a place of great wholeness and power and... Fine. So when I'm on retreat, and most of my life, because I'm often alone, I'm very comfortable with that now from years of being on my own and moving through space and traveling alone. And then I always enjoy to be with people. But I'm also comfortable alone, but I'm not lonely in that space. I've been lonely. I've definitely been lonely. So I understand the difference between lonely and aloneness. And sometimes people ask me if I'm on retreat for a few months, particularly at Laudo, that is very remote and far away. And they're, you know, some people I've been up there with who said, you know, you're going to be here for 4 months? You know, do you get lonely? And I'm not. I've got my program. I know exactly what I'm doing there. I need that time. I chose to be alone in it. And it's very sorted now, the alone time. Like I'm, because I've done it. The first time I was up there, it was difficult. It was difficult, but it was mostly my mind that was difficult. And this is where the loneliness comes from. So once I got past that, it tended to, I'm used to it now, so I know what those little nostalgic places come up where I long for people, you know, or this, all of a sudden something will come up. Now I'm like, okay, I've dealt with that. It's not a problem anymore. So I think it's helpful when you can. I know some people, long-term couples, one dies, they've never had a meal alone, never had a meal in public alone, never gone to a movie alone, never gone for a walk alone, never, you know. So that's very scary for people when you are going to be alone at some point that you've never experienced that. Yes, Kim.
I was just thinking of kind of one.
They're coming.
Thanks, Susie. Number one, I think one of the loneliest positions is to be lonely in a marriage. I think that's one of the loneliest pieces that you can have, because you're in bed with the same person and you're still completely alone. But I think for me, you know, I can, as an extrovert, I can say, I'm feeling lonely. But then I start thinking about, well, who can I call or who would I like to be with? Then I just start ticking off all the people that I would like to be with, and I'm like, no, that's not really going to fill me up. That's not really going to help. you know, that's not really going to help. Not that I don't like them, but it's just like, oh, that's not going to help, that's not going to help. Then I realize I'm nostalgic for connections that I'm not feeling at that moment. And then I start thinking, but wait, those connections that I had, those moments of connection, they're gone. And that moment, that specific moment, they're never going to come again. So I'm longing for something that is actually not in reality, you know. So then, you know, so then you're left. So this is to me, this is kind of the structure of getting into being your own, you know, best friend and learning to, I think that's a big challenge, you know, for me to learn to be my own best friend.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, that's to me what spiritual practice is about. Part of the essence of it. And thank you. And I think it's really great to be that self-reflective, to notice, like, I'm an extrovert and I'm reaching out and you have to go in and explore it. Like, I'm longing for this person right now. Go and dance with the person in a meditation, meaning just hang out with them and see what's really going on there. It tends to dissolve pretty quick. What's going on with this one? Why am I so... What's happening with this one? The need. And then you realize, I'm actually okay with myself and finding those pockets. So I've done a lot of that on retreat, especially my first couple retreats. If you do a retreat that might be longer than a week or so and you're alone with your mind, it can be completely unnerving. But then you pass through that space and I think you're much better than before and you never go through that space exactly like that again. We did a, and we will take a break in this session, so if you have to go to the bathroom, we're going to take a break in a little bit, at Vajrapani, we instituted a winter retreat. I couldn't pay people more, so I realized I could give more time off. And because we were a retreat center, I wanted the staff to understand what it was to do retreat. Some of them had never done retreat, so we had a month's retreat, January. I'm not sure if they still do it today, but... We had a month's retreat, and we were semi-closed, and one guy said he'd cook because we had some retreat cabins booked with other people. So then I asked the staff the first year, what kind of retreat do you want to do? Do you want to do a group retreat? Do you want to do your own individual retreat? And the deal was it wasn't holiday. You had to do retreat. You could do retreat at the center, or you could go to a place that was hosting a retreat and do it, but it was about doing retreat. So we had a woman at the center, a young woman working, was incredibly rigid. And she's like, oh, no, I'm doing individual retreat by myself. I'm in silence. I'm not talking to anybody. I'm doing my own retreat for a month. Okay. So we all decided through this process we're going to do our own retreats. Great. So off we went. And 2 weeks later, the cook told me later, she came running down to the main building, totally freaked out, of like, why didn't you tell me? And she's just alone with her mind for the first time. And stuff comes up. And a lot of stuff, what tends to sometimes surface first is all the stuff you don't like about yourself. All these really intense negative things, and she had never looked at that stuff, and so she didn't quite know how to process it. And that's what we do in our spiritual work, is slowly, you know, working on little bits of meditation every day so that you're slowly building up a thing to understand, wow, I just was... so rude to that person. What went on? Like, look at it at the end of the day. What happened? What was I? Oh, and then you realize underneath the rudeness is I was really upset about something. And I felt like these people left me out and I'd never be picked for that project. And, you know, so you're slowly trying to weave this through your everyday activities. And then when you can get a little bit more time in meditation, then you try to do that if you can. That. So, some of the things Jhimpa mentions is all the lonely people are like fish swimming at the edge of a school, exposed to the threat of predators. So we know with loneliness, when you are lonely, you're more susceptible to other negative behaviors, bad health practices, things like that. And so that creates all these other stress levels for you, basically. So... and I'd say there's no doubt today there's a huge link between, there's a lot of widespread loneliness, I would say. Many people lonely. And our culture, modern culture's emphasis on autonomy and an individualistic lifestyle. Okay, because a lot of that undermines social connectedness. So sometimes you have to fight against it to say, no, I can do all this. I know when I moved to Vajrapani and I was going to do everything myself, right? The first year when I showed up, I remembered every day I had to kind of be like, okay, so I have to ask so-and-so for help today. I'm going to have to ask him to help me with this thing in my cabin that's broken. I have to ask this person. I could, in the city, you're doing it anyway. You just call a repairman and you pay them. Repair person and you pay them. But now I had to really, like, ask my friend in person. I can't do this by myself. Right? It was the greatest lesson for me. Huge transformation. Because, again, of our interdependence, the interconnectedness. So you may surprise yourself. When you do reach out and do it, initially you're not familiar with it, so it's scary. Because the person may turn me down. That's okay, I'm going to go to another person. Not everybody will turn you down. We have a fear of rejection. Right? They can't reject me because I'm okay. I'm the same person I was before I asked them. So I'm still okay. Now I ask them, they don't want to help, I'm still the same person, I'm okay. The stories, the ruminating negative stories say, oh, I guess they don't like me, I'm bad. No, I'm the same person. You have different karma with people. Okay? So some people may just not be in that space where they can help or they want to help. You don't have the connection. That's okay. Go to another person. Just keep trying. But what happens is we reach out a little bit, then you have a bad experience and you go back and you retreat and then back to my loneliness. That was safer. It's not a place you want to stay. And I know it's hard sometimes. It's hard. And then we also become, you know, and one thing I would look at, and this is a lot of younger generation, but not necessarily, is our addiction to social media. Those of you that are glommed on to that, if there's anyone in here. Anyone in here? No, of course not, right? Not just social media, technology. How much time are you spending in the box? Sorry, the reason I have these here is I teach from them now. I have all these materials on these little devices, which is fantastic because I don't have to lug a bunch of books around with me. but how much, is there a balance in your life? I have tech holidays, so I don't even turn the devices on, right? It's freedom. I love the space when, I don't care who emails me that day. It's like I'm not focused on that. So what do you notice you have time for when you're not here? And then you went here just to check one thing, and now a half an hour is gone. You were going to do something else. You were going to meditate. Oh, well, a great excuse. I just need to check. You know, get your phone out of the room when you want to meditate, because it's very enticing. Very enticing. I'm just going to check one thing. Oh, there goes my meditation session. Okay. So that's another thing I think that contributes to disconnect. You know, I can just talk to you in the box, but to talk to you in person... Well, that's going to require something. Do I have to do that? Okay. And then the other thing, and I just keep coming back to connection. So when you sometimes are faced with someone and you want to fix the suffering and the pain, somebody comes to you with something insurmountable. This happens sometimes. We have this at centers. Somebody comes to a Buddhist center, they'll make it all right for me. They'll fix me. Okay, and what would happen is sometimes we came in contact with people that were just complaining. You know, I think as a culture, Americans, we complain a lot. Right? Do you know the Yiddish expression kvetch, to complain? What's the term? I kvetch, therefore I am. Right? Some people feel that way. If I'm not complaining, I'm not living, right? Simply not true. So what I found was, so His Holiness, there's a story of His Holiness where a man, His Holiness stopped somebody. I don't know if it was a crowd or he was entering a place to teach and there were all these people. And somebody was saying about the pointlessness of their life over and over. And His Holiness kept coming back with, you know, reasons why your life is not pointless. Kept coming back over and over. And the man just kept having another reason. And sometimes you meet someone like this. It could be a family member. I'm suffering, there's no point, I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to volunteer, I'm lonely, I'm depressed, it's just always like this. And so His Holiness, nothing worked, right? And so His Holiness finally just threw his arms around him and hugged him. The guy started sobbing. just melted him. Just, and then the guy felt much better. You know, so we got this kind of, some people have this wall up around them, impenetrable. Okay, and sometimes it's just some kind of physical, you just put your hand on somebody, hold their hand, I'm here. You know, I was thinking of my thing with Rick with in the bed when he was screaming, just had my hand on his back. I was like, I mean, I think I did it for me. I was so freaked out that I was going to leave, so I thought, if I'll just stay connected to him, like a magnet, I won't leave. You know, because it was so difficult, so difficult. So that's okay. That's okay. You're just trying to show up with your mind, and our minds are not perfect. And you know what? That's okay. That's okay. So connecting, opening your heart to others, caring, allowing our heart, this is a bigger thing, to be touched by others' kindness. Sometimes we have a wall up. I'm not going to receive. You know how we have a thing in our culture? I don't know if you have this. I had this from my family. That there were certain gifts you could get, like on your birthday. Christmas or Hanukkah, like that was okay. But if somebody gave you a gift at another time of the year, that wasn't okay. So for instance, my grandmother, she didn't have a lot of money, but she sometimes wanted to give us money, a little bit of money. It's a nice offering. Like Tibetan Buddhist tradition, we have a big tradition of this. But a lot of Westerners don't live like this. So she would do something. My mother would see something, would see her slipping me something, right? And then later my mother said, did she give you any money? And I'd be like, yes. Like I didn't know it was wrong initially. I'm like, give it back to her. So if you can't receive, how can somebody else give? You know, but somehow we kind of grew up this way. A lot of us grew up that way. And I remember the beginning, I was in 87. I was in Tibet, and Rinpoche led a trip with 60 students. But I was first in Tibet with two Western monks that we traveled ahead of the group, because there's many people coming in different groups. And we were in a town, in a city, for like a week staying there and looking at all the beautiful sights there and the temples. And so a great lama came, and we were in a big dorm room with like 12 beds. And a lama came for like one or two nights and stayed in the dorm room with us. There was no other place. So they put us in the dorm room and his attendant was there and he was like a couple beds over from me. And I was just getting into meditating, so I was trying to meditate a lot. I didn't really know anything about meditation, but I would try. I'd get in the position and close my eyes and hope that like God would appear. You know, I didn't exactly know what, but you know, I was giving it my best shot of like, I noticed how I was starting to notice my mind. And that was helpful to see, there seems to be something there that, so I was sitting on my bed meditating and people were lined up to see him, like queued up around the room. And they were dropping like money, Chinese money into my lap because they saw me as like a meditator. I was a lay person. And initially I was like, these people are poor, so poor. And I remember one of the monks, Western monks, saw me wanting to give it, and he said, don't give it back. It's a total insult to them to return it. And so we have bodhisattva vows, actually, now that when somebody does offer you something, you have to receive it. You can offer it. You can say, I receive it, and you can offer it back or offer it to something else. But there is a vow, and it was completely adverse to the way I was raised. Very interesting, that. So it really taught me a lot about generosity, because I love to give. You know, I love to give when I can. I don't have a lot of money, but I really like to put it out there. And it's also the cause of your prosperity, your generosity. So it's interesting that. It was something new to me. Okay. So actually, we are born to connect. We are born to connect. Our longing for connection, not just with humans, with animals, it's so deep, it determines your experience of happiness. We're really born for that. You know, so sometimes we do get isolated. You know, are you isolating yourself? And sometimes there's other ways that you can be isolated like that. So it's something to examine. And there are periods in our life, just due to karmic arisal, that you may be more isolated. You may be more isolated. Okay? I'm connecting now with David and Elise's dog, Tashi. We have a big mutual fan club going on. You know, I've explored a couple of her squeaky toys, and we've, you know, been merging over. One of these really excitable dogs who's just so thrilled to have somebody there. It's very exciting. Okay. So Geshe-la, I think, is talking. Is Geshe-la talking about patience now on Wednesday night? You're doing the six perfections. So usually our loved ones are usually could be the primary benefactors of kindness to us. The people closest to us are people we're comfortable to be kind with, and they often show us greatest kindness, can be our greatest source of happiness. For the same reason, though, they can also cause us the greatest hurt. So feeling compassion for a loved one might come naturally now and again, but to sustain the kindness on an ongoing basis, especially with those closest to you, okay, especially in the face of adversity, is where you're going to grow your patience. And you need to grow the patience to get enlightened. That's why other beings are your most precious jewel. Because just on your own, you're not really practicing much patience. Just on your own, it's not happening. We need other beings to get enlightened. That's where we really start to expand the heart. I'm not in this bubble by myself. Sorry to break it to you. You're not going to get enlightened by yourself. It just is not going to happen. But notice how you are treating those closest to you. I've talked about this in past classes. Because we're coming up to Valentine's Day. Compassion is related to love. Okay, but it is more wishing others to be free of suffering as opposed to wanting them to be happy. How do you treat those closest to you? Pretty generously and considerately and really caring for them. I got a face over here that's like a little embarrassed. How's it going? This is your dearest person on the planet to you. You love this person more than anyone. Isn't it extraordinary how sometimes we're not that kind to them? Right? So this is your practice. This is a fantastic practice. And next time you see them or when you leave here today, please, can you treat them like a rare jewel? Like you've got this honored guest now in your life. How do you want to treat them the rest of the day? Okay. You guys are working it out, right? Okay. You're going to get a little exercise going. Okay. David and Karen, go for it. Great. What's that?
It's a rare jewel.
Rare jewel. Okay. And you're going to test his patience to see how it goes. But did you ever notice, I've done this before in here, this is your greatest loved one speaking to you. Okay. You hear them all the time. You sleep next to them maybe. Or they're in your household. You're always there. We take them for granted. Now they're speaking. What do you hear? Yep. That's right. They're talking, and it becomes, you know, and then later they say, I told you, and then you say, no, you didn't. Yes, I did. No, you didn't. And then you have a fight. So an offering you can give them is, did you ever just single-pointedly listen to them? We listen while we're multitasking because we're busy. You're that busy for this person, you can't take 2 minutes? Such a great offering. I mentioned one time before, so Milarepa Center, I had a manager once, wonderful woman, good friend, and we have a country kitchen. It was a country kitchen with a wooden table in the middle. She was washing dishes, her back to me cooking across the kitchen. And she's talking about something I thought was important, and we had also been talking before about that we didn't listen to each other very well, and that we thought that was a problem of a breakdown in our helping the center. Very common. Happens all the time at centers. Right? It's really about fostering the connection so you have good communication. Because it's built on the connection. The connection's built on good communication. So we kind of identified that was an issue and we would do better. And now that I was cooking, I realized I'm not really paying enough attention right now. So I shut the burner off, turned around to the table like this. And I was just watching her back, listening. Totally listening. She's talking. She stops the water, finishes, dries her hands, turns around, and she sees me. And what does she say? What's wrong? Right? And I said, I'm just listening to you. Right? It totally melted her. She said, oh, like it was a great offer. It was so something so simple, so easy to do. So that's for the people closest to you, your inner circle. Are you present with them? Sometimes I know we need to multitask, okay? You do better time management so that sometimes you're not doing something when you're especially in person in front of them because they see you. Oh, yeah, I'm listening, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, so your mother's coming on Monday. Okay, great. All the time we're like that. And then you got your computer popping up with sounds, and I mean, okay, so that would be one thing is please try so the patients to sustain kindness on this ongoing basis, especially when things get tough between you. And my dad is almost 90. It's very difficult for him. He's still independent. He's doing really well, but I see the decline, and I see him resisting it. It's hard. So sometimes he lashes out. It's just normal. You know, it's just the way he tended to do his stuff. So he tends to do that, and I'm the only one there. You know, one time we had a joke. What was the joke? He was a blamer, my dad. He doesn't do it much, but he's an unbelievable blamer. Always had to find out who put the. And then I said, and then when you find out, then what?
Right.
You know, like somebody intentionally broke the knob on the stove? Really? Like, okay, so he turned it too hard and it broke. And so he had to be, who did the, you know, okay. So, and he was 6'5" of him with a booming voice. Very scary, okay? So, this was his thing. So I grew up in House of Blame. We used to joke. So my sister and brother and my mom, I was living in California. My sister was in New York. So they were on the East Coast together, my mom living with him. They made a game for him. They got tired of it. The three of them divided up the year. Each of them had 4 months. When it was your month, it was your fault, whether you were there or not. And I came home, I visited from California, and my father went off on something. Where are my socks? And my sister was in the house, and my sister said, oh, wait a minute, it's October, it's Brad's month, my brother. He's not even there. And I went, what? He said, well, we divided up the year, so it's easy now, so Dad knows if it's the autumn, it's Brad. And that cut my father. He would laugh. He would realize how ridiculous he was. He would realize. So I'm the only one now in the house. So it's always my fault. Okay? And so one point I said to him, he called me in South Florida. I was teaching at our center last year. So he calls me and I was gone for 2.5 weeks maybe. So I knew that I had done the laundry, but in 2.5 weeks he had done the laundry again. So then he calls me, where did I put the detergent? And then I said, it was all me, and the detergent, you didn't put it back, you know, and I said, well, it's probably, you know where it is? I said, it's probably the last place you put it. You did the laundry last, and that kind of catches him when I say that. Like, I know where it is, and I go, there, like, let's retrace. So then he found it, and everything was fine. And then I said to him, who do you blame when I'm not there? You know, it got him thinking that he just realized, because the same stuff was happening when I'm not there, because he's forgetting. You know, but when I'm there, it's easy to find the target. But I'm not there, it's him. So it's little exercises is when you have more adversity like that, I need more patience with my dad, and he needs patience with me, and he needs also patience with himself. But he doesn't have much familiarity with that. I'll take your question in a sec. He doesn't have the familiarity. So I'm a little bit introducing that to him. I don't expect him to change much because he's almost 90. But he's doing really well. He's adapting. You know, from little comments, like, who do you blame when I'm not there? Like, he realizes these things happen, and he gets irritated, but it's just him. And I'm also getting him to just deflect, you don't need to blame yourself. I'm like, this is a natural part of life, aging. And I kind of joke with him because he's got the major aging at 90 where the body, right? But at my age, I've also got some body limitations. And he'll go, well, yeah, that's from, and I'm aging. And I'm like, yeah. And I said, well, it really helps me appreciate more what's going on for you with your back or, you know, so there's like this connection again. Now I have empathy with him. So more connection in a positive way. Comment, question.
Is this on? Can you hear me?
I hear you.
Well, a lot of what you're saying really resonates with me, and I want to
tie it back, just a question of advice for self-care. And some of those, my family, similarly, I guess, was kind of this boisterous Irish Catholic, French-Canadian type family, and everybody yells and expresses themselves, and it's, I never quite fit into that, never really cared for that. And somehow, especially now that I'm practicing Buddhism, some aspects of it, I feel like it's misinterpreted as I'm trying to be better than, or, you know, it's not received well. So I guess, how do you deal with that anger without, you know, you don't want to lash out or cause divisiveness or get involved, but suddenly they're noticing that reframing all the time, and they're noticing that I'm saying, no, you know, I don't want to talk about that, talk to her directly, and they're just not happy with my response. Do you have any suggestions for how to take care of myself?
So did you say the reframing or refraining?
Reframing.
Reframing with an M.
Right, like if somebody says, oh, you know, that's just X, Y, Z, and I'm like, well, you know, he has dementia, or he's trying his best.
Reframing, I mean, I think part of it is to stand your authenticity, like hold the line. I would sometimes enter humor into it if it's appropriate. I can make a joke about something, and you know, rather than coming onto a moral high ground with it. And it's a little bit of an attitude shift. Sometimes it's a tone of the voice. Where, and the other thing is, families, if you're close with your families or even not, but they're in your lives, they do hold you hostage by not wanting you to change, because this is how they function like that. So they don't really like it that, you know, unless there's a shared behavior where several, like my sister, brother, and I decided we're not taking the blame anymore. Like, that's enough. He's done that enough for enough years, and we decided together, you know. So I would just say, if you can find ways in like that where it's not that I'm better, it's just that I'm just, and just, you could say maybe aside to somebody, I'm just not comfortable with, it's just not where I am right now, is to continue just criticizing him, and, you know. And I might not even, if you're just an example, sometimes you could just be an example. But I would just keep reaching out friendly to them in a way that you have been, and slowly make the changes, so then they don't notice it as radical anymore. You know, it doesn't mean you have to give in to the yelling and screaming and criticizing and name calling, and you can, you know, and sometimes I've just left a room so that I'm not there to engage, where they're going to get into, I've just exited stage left. Oh, I've got to go to, excuse me, I'm just going to go to the bathroom, I'll be right down. And I wait till I hear it quiet down. And then I'm back, and, you know, just there, standing against the wall. So I don't know if that's helpful.
Yeah, that is. Thank you.
Yeah, and if you can find humor, trying to think of an example where I, sometimes with my father, oh, I know, when, like, he used to have, he doesn't do this anymore. This is what's been interesting. I come down for breakfast. Just the way he and my mom, whatever, however they evolved that relationship. I mean, they did have a good relationship. It wasn't one I would aspire to, but it worked for them 50-some years and until she passed away. So I come down for breakfast, and he would have some kind of offhand critical remark. This is my morning, you know. And it, I mean, it could be like, you look like crap. He's not a bad person. He's not a bad person. It just is, you see, years of habitual doing it one way. It's just habit. I don't fault him. I'm not angry at him for it. I used to be, but I'm not anymore. I just see it's simply habit, you know. And my mother tolerated it, let it go. I'm not blaming her. She had her own stuff. That was, but that's, you know, so you look like crap, and I counter with, good morning to you, bundle of sunshine, with a big smile on my face. And then he realizes, it doesn't fit there. It doesn't fit anymore. You're trying to get that jigsaw puzzle in where it's always gone because my mom was there and it fit. Doesn't fit anymore. So he doesn't do it anymore. I get good morning. Good, you know. Very. So again, I didn't expect, you can't, especially someone old, don't expect any changes in them. That's not why we do it. But I'm just working with my own mind. It's the only thing I can change. Slowly. So I want to take a break, then we're going to come back and do, so some of you did your external practice this morning and went to the march. So now we get to do our internal practice. This is part of informing our internal practice. I just want to expose you to that a little bit. It's really helpful. Okay? So I want you to take a break, and we are going to get it more into self-compassion. We've just started that part. And think a little bit more, talk a little bit more about experiences of loneliness you've had, what has helped, what coping mechanisms, what doesn't help, and can continue to talk about self-compassion. We'll take about 15 minutes. Please take your seats. Thank you. I just realized that we don't have a lot of time, and I want to introduce you. Some of you are familiar. This is a simple forearm Chenrezig practice. Chenrezig in Tibetan is the Buddha of compassion. In Sanskrit, Avalokiteshvara, very long word. And this is, there's different versions of this Buddha. If you look at the front of the room, the top left corner, there's a square gold picture there. That's the thousand-arm Chenrezig. Thousand arms. He has a thousand arms. Every hand has an eye. So he sees all the different beings that need help. His job is to free them of suffering. The ancient legends are that he became so overwhelmed with the suffering, he cried. And out of his tears sprang Tara, the green goddess. There's 21 versions of her, as you can see from this gorgeous altar of all the Tara statues. It's very powerful. And so she sprang, very energetic mode, the green Tara, I will help you, basically, like that. This is a beautiful practice. I just adapted this from something we had done some time ago. And so just sit comfortably. And sometimes you can just visualize. If I say visualize, and then other times I'll point you to a page where we have an option to read together if you like. So once again, find that motivation. Just check your motivation, that intention. Keeping the mind buoyant in as positive a framework as possible. So in doing some compassion work, it's also helpful sometimes to focus on a practice. So when we're done with external work and other things, reciting the mantra of the Buddha of compassion, Om Mani Padme Hum, or Om Mani Padme Hum, can be very powerful. It has an inner resonance. The actual syllables are not that important, but to some degree, Om, O-M, is an opener for most mantras. Hung, or Hum, H-U-M, is a closer. The Om is technically made up of three syllables that represent the body, speech, and mind of the Enlightened One, so it gets us closer to that. And the Hung is representative of the five Buddha families and all their positive qualities. Also gets us closer to that. Mani is jewel. Padme is lotus. Mani represents the jewel of emptiness, the correct view of seeing. And Padme is the lotus rising out of the swamp. The skillful means we need to get enlightened, untouched by any stains, can also represent emptiness here as well. So basically, these are often, these mantras, their essence is about merging wisdom and emptiness. Sorry, merging compassion and wisdom. Your right method and your right view. Those are the two wings of the bird you need to get enlightened. So in some way, the essence of the mantra could be that the all of the universe is like a jewel in the lotus of my heart. And since we've generated the compassionate motivation first, the right intention, any reflection you have on emptiness to do this practice is very powerful as well. If you don't know what emptiness means, no worries. So visualize right now in the space in front of you, a few feet in front of you, seated on a white lotus flower and a moon disc lying flat, is the divine form of Chenrezig Zig. He's facing you a few inches in height, and imagine as much as you can, everything is in the nature of light. And he is the embodiment of all the Buddha's infinite compassion. He's white in color with one face and four arms. First two hands are joined together at his heart, holding a wish-fulfilling gem. His second right hand holds a crystal rosary. His second left hand holds a white lotus. And he's seated in the Vajra posture. The legs are crossed with each foot on each opposing thigh. And he's clothed in fine silks and radiant jewels. If it's difficult to visualize, just imagine this radiant white light in the space in front that represents infinite compassion. And he's slightly higher than the level of your forehead. Imagine at his forehead now is a white Om syllable standing upright in the nature of light, O-M. At his throat is a red Ah, A-H. At his heart, a blue Hum, H-U-M, representing the body, speech, and mind of all the holy beings. Just imagine light emanating from these three syllables and inviting Arya Chenrezig from his natural abode. And imagine that that Chenrezig dissolves into the Guru Chenrezig in the space in front. In a sense, breathes life into our visualization. So that the Chenrezig in front becomes the essence of the three jewels of refuge, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, inseparable from that. So if you'd like, on page 3, we can recite the refuge bodhicitta intention 3 times, taking refuge and generating the altruistic intention. I take refuge until I'm enlightened in the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the Sangha through the positive potential I create by practicing giving and other perfections. May I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all living beings. I take refuge until I am enlightened in the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the Sangha through the positive potential I create by practicing giving and other perfections. May I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all living beings. I take refuge until I am enlightened in the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the Sangha through the positive potential I create by practicing giving and other perfections. May I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all living beings. The four immeasurables are a very powerful prayer. They are immeasurable based on the countless living beings we send these wishes out to. Immeasurable due to the scope of the prayers. No limit on those. This starts with immeasurable equanimity, having equal regard, equal respect for all beings, regardless of whether they harm or help us. And then immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, and immeasurable joy. So we'll recite these. how wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were to abide in equanimity, free from attachment and hatred. May they abide in equanimity. I shall bring about this. Please, Guru Deity, inspire me to be able to do so. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings had happiness and its cause. May they have happiness and its cause. I shall bring about this. Please, Guru Deity, inspire me to be able to do so. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were free from suffering and its cause. May they be free from suffering and its cause. I shall bring about this. Please, Guru Deity, inspire me to be able to do so. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were never parted from higher rebirth and liberation's excellent bliss. May they never be parted from these. I shall bring about this. Please, Guru Deity, inspire me to be able to do so. Special altruistic intention, just enhancing our motivation, the top of page 4. Especially for the sake of all mother sentient beings, I must quickly in this very life attain the precious state of complete and perfect Buddhahood. Therefore, I shall practice the profound yoga of Guru Chenrezig. Seven limb prayer, we usually put our hands in prostration mudra. It's a very powerful prayer that involves paying respect or homage, making offerings, confessing non-virtues, rejoicing in positive efforts, asking the Buddhists to stay until samsara ends, asking them to teach or turn the wheel of Dharma, and dedicating all the virtue. So with feeling, really thinking about what you're reciting, reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind, and present clouds of every type of offering, actual and mentally transformed. I confess all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the virtues of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until psychic existence ends, and turn the wheel of Dharma for all living beings. I dedicate all the virtues of myself and others to the great enlightenment. The mandala offering, again, is part of our request that I'm going to ask Chenrezig. We all want Chenrezig to help us to purify and actually open our hearts more to compassion. So this is symbolic of that. Bottom of page 4. We'll read in English. You're visualizing the most magnificent universe you can imagine. This ground anointed with perfume, flowers strewn, Mount Meru, four lands, sun and moon, imagined as a Buddha land and offered to you, may all beings enjoy this pure land. The objects of attachment, aversion and ignorance, friends, enemies and strangers, my body, wealth and enjoyments, I offer these without any sense of loss. Please accept them with pleasure and inspire me and others to be free from the three poisonous minds. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niratayami. So the requesting prayer is very important on page 5. We don't sometimes in our culture understand requests. The only reason teachers teach at the center is because they've been requested. And whatever will benefit the center, whatever possible flourishing of the center comes due to requests that individual students make. The reason the Light of the Path retreat happens is the center people have requested that retreat from Rinpoche to happen, for Rinpoche to join us for that retreat, made heartfelt requests and created the causes. So requests create the causes for the good things to happen. So also be careful for what you wish for. You can be very specific in your requests. So let's recite this together. And this comes in the Nungne practice, which is a 2-day fasting retreat. Nungne means abiding in the fast. And you do a beautiful practice to this Buddha, the thousand-armed Chenrezig, reciting some mantras, and this request prayer has a chantable version. It's very beautiful. So we'll read this together. O Arya Chinresi, treasure of compassion, please listen to me. I request you to guide me and all living beings of the six realms quickly from the great ocean of samsara. May the vast and profound peerless bodhicitta grow within my mind. With the tear of your great compassion, please cleanse all karmas and delusion. With your compassionate loving hand, lead me and all migrators to fields of bliss. Please, Amitabha and Chenrezig, in all my lives be virtuous friends, show well the infallible pure path, and quickly place us in Buddha's state. Chenrezig is in the Amitabha Buddha family. That's why Amitabha is mentioned. The special request. Please, Guru Chenrezig, help me to generate infinite love and compassion. May the precious mind of enlightenment arise and grow within me now in this very session. So imagine you can just close your eyes, that the Chenrezig in the front space is very happy to help us. And imagine that he comes to the crown of your head, facing the same direction as you. And you can imagine that infinite numbers of Chenrezig come to the top of the heads of all living beings you can imagine seated around you, whether they're just in this room, or you can bring in family, friends, colleagues, expanding out, till just imagine all the space you can imagine is filled in the universe with living beings with Chenrezig on their crown, this Buddha of compassion. And imagine at Chenrezig's tiny heart, right in the center of his chest, there is a lotus flower and a moon disc lying flat. At the center of the moon standing is his seed syllable, Shri. You can imagine H-R-I. In the nature of white light, Shri. And this is the essence of Chenrezig's omniscient mind of wisdom and compassion. Around the edge of the moon disc is his long mantra, standing clockwise like a strand of radiant pearls. Inside the long mantra, around the seed syllable, is his shorter mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. And again, all of it is in the nature of radiant light. If you happen to look at the front of your booklet, there's a circle here with syllables in it. The center is the seed syllable Shri. At the top is Om. Go to the right of the Om is Ma. The next one is Ni. At the bottom, 6 o'clock, Pe, or I think it's Pame, and then Pem, Mi, the next syllable, and this last one, which is just to the left of the Om, is Hung. So it's like that. That's at his heart, like this, standing, and then outside of that, around the moon disc, is the bigger mantra, just to give you some context, all in the nature of white light, as much as you can visualize. You just go back to your visualization. And just visualize the English letters if you're not familiar, and just do the best you can do. And imagine now that from the mantra garlands and the Shri, the seed syllable, infinite white light and nectar representing the nature of Chenrezig's blissful, omniscient mind, it begins to pour forth, and it begins to fill his entire body and begins to overflow out of all the pores of Chenrezig's body over our crown and over the crowns of all the living beings around us. And it pours down through the crown of our head, healing, radiant nectar of compassion, like a cascading waterfall. Goes right into your body through your crown, permeating your entire nervous system. Totally purifies all disturbing attitudes, negative karmic imprints, diseases, anything that obscures you from opening your heart and feeling compassion for yourself and for others. They grant all realizations, such as a loving, compassionate mind. As much as you can, feel completely pure and blissful. And imagine this is the experience happening to all the living beings you want to visualize around you. Or feel free to just focus on the chinrasig on your crown. So we're going to recite one time the long mantra on page 6. Again, to go through a little literal translation is not so important. It's about calling on the different aspects of chinrasig, their holy body, speech, and mind, can please help protect me from suffering, grant me compassion. It's kind of the essence of may I attain bliss and emptiness. Like that. So if you'd like, you can join. We'll do it slowly. And then we're going to recite, chant some of the six-syllable mantra.
Namo Ratnatraya Namo Arya Jnana Sagara Bero Tsana Buha Radzaya Tata Gataya Arhate samyak sambuddhaya Namo sarva tata katye bhye Arhate bhye samyak sambuddhe bhye Namo arya avalokite Shoraya bodhisattoya Mahasattoya Mahakarunikaya Tayata Om Dara Dara Diri Diri Duru Duru Ite Vate Tsale Tsale Patsale Patsale Kusume Kusume Vare Ili Mili Ziti Zola Apanae Soham.
And then as best as you can keep the visualization going, light nectar descending down to your crown, purifying all diseases, all obscurations from your opening your heart more and more to compassion.
Mani Bhame Hong. Mani Bhame Hong. Om Mani Bhame Hong. Om Mani Bhame Hong. Om Mani Bhame Hong. Mani Bhame Hong. Om Mani Bhame Hong. Om Mani Padme Hum.
Can they hear you in all of Raleigh?
Om Mani Padme Hum. Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum.
Let's recite a little on our own, so you do need to articulate the mantra so air does leave your mouth, but not loud enough to disturb the person seated next to you. You can go at any pace that you like, trying to keep the visualization going as best as you can. Om Mani Padme Hum.
Om Mani Padme Hum. Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum.
Just reflect for a moment on the preciousness of your life as a human who has met the Dharma by just reflecting on the wonderful, wonderful situations you have right now in your life. I know we all have problems, but there are some wonderful opportunities, wonderful conditions. You can also reflect on your good qualities. So just imagine right now that the chenrasigs on the crowns of all the living beings in the space around us melt into light, dissolving into all of these beings and blessing them so that they may swiftly reach enlightenment. Imagine them just dissolving back into the space from which they came. And just think, I will live my life in a meaningful way and do all actions with the motivation to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all living beings. Because I have a sincere intention, Chenrasig is extremely pleased. And imagine now he melts into a radiant crystal drop. And the drop dissolves into the crown of my head, absorbing to my heart. Just think that your body becomes pure and clear like crystal. Just concentrate on this as best as you can. And imagine that your body dissolves into clear light space and all ordinary concepts vanish. Any reflection you have on emptiness, think about that now. Things do not appear the way you think they do. They do not exist how they appear. And they do not appear the way they exist. Completely lack any inherent nature from their own side. And just imagine now, from the emptiness, from the wisdom, you arise in your ordinary form. Once again, here in the room, with a loving, compassionate mind. page 8. We'll just read the first couple paragraphs of dedication. Due to this merit, may I soon attain the enlightened state of Chenrei Zig, so that I might be able to liberate all living beings from their sufferings. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. I just wanted to give you a taste of this practice. That was roughly 20, 30 minutes. But you can do it much more quickly. If you don't have a lot of time, you just quickly visualize Chenrei Zig. You know, you could say a few of these prayers. There's a short version of the four immeasurables. May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the happiness that knows no suffering. May all beings never be separated from equanimity, feeling close to some and distant from others. That's the short version. I believe it's in this book, maybe a short version, but it's very easy to find. So if you don't have time, you can just quickly quickly do as many mantras as you like. It's something that set a good intention, Chenrei Zig there, a few prayers, something so that you don't prevent yourself from doing a practice when you feel you need more compassion. Be very powerful. So some of our internal work to inform the external work. Helpful?
Yes.
Like that? It's very powerful. The mantra is very, very powerful. It's also one of our shortest mantras. So, you know, you're in traffic. Mani Padme Hum, Mani Padme Hum, Mani Padme Hum, Mani Padme Hum. Just better than some garbage like I'm in traffic, hate that guy. Right? Just, right? And the four immeasurables you can send out there. You're in traffic. May you be happy. May you have all the causes of happiness. May you be free from suffering. You know, why not send that out to the universe? It has a ripple effect on the planet. Right? We've seen the effects. You see somebody getting angry around you. You see the effects that has. How people, he's getting, you know. So this is the ripple effect of compassion. Back. The four immeasurables, I've mentioned this before, in its short form, is in the Return of the Jedi. Any Star Wars fans in here? Right? We love those movies, right? So George Lucas is a Buddhist. The first three films are all based on Buddhist premises. The dark side is simply your delusions. Like that. So at the end of Return of the Jedi, the Ewoks are chanting the Four Immeasurables in Tibetan, clear as day. So we all get a seed of that. Everyone who went to that movie got a seed planted of the four immeasurables. So you can have quite a nice effect when you roll out something to mass audiences like that. If you want to put positive twist on it, we've seen the effects of the negative stuff that's out there. A lot of violent films. You see what it does to people's minds. You see maybe with your teenagers that play a lot of violent video games, I have seen the effect on their minds of that. So you just see the imprints. What are you have to ask yourself, what are you familiar with? What's your mind familiar with? Is it familiar with this mudra? Right? Or is it familiar with something else? You want to slowly be skillful, you know. Any questions, comments? Yes, Susie.
I have trouble, or I would like you to explain again the disc and how the mantras, how the syllables are standing, please.
Yep. So he's got a little tiny heart because he's small. He's only a few inches in height above our crown. At his heart, there's a moon disc lying flat. Under it is a white lotus flower, beautiful petals of a lotus. Moon disc is on here. Okay. In the center, I have Shri, seed syllable, but you can have it standing upright. Either the visualize the syllable or H-R-I, sometimes spelled H-R-I-H. It's the same. Nature of light. Around that, like a little strand of pearls, Om Mani Padme Hum. but standing clockwise. And then around that is the longer mantra. And that's a mantra, those mantras we recite in the Nungne practice.
Usually I see, I do Vajrasattva practice, and it's also, usually they're sitting on a lotus flower, and then it's a moon disc. Why moon disc? What is the significance for Tibetan?
So the lotus in that sense represents renunciation, because the lotus rises unstained from the swamp. So we're trying to get out of samsara, out of the stains of samsara. The moon disc technically usually represents bodhicitta, the heart of enlightenment, the awakened attitude. If there's a sun disc as well, which Shakyamuni Buddha practiced, he sits on a lotus sun and moon. The sun represents the wisdom realizing emptiness because it illuminates everything in that context. Yeah. So here I think in Om Mani Padme Hung, the lotus there, let me just double check. The jewel in the lotus there, I think, may also represent emptiness in that case, because they're trying to show that it's emptiness that gets you out of the swamp. I can't remember. I'll have to check my notes. Or is that the compassion there? Because it's so, it's such an incredible attitude to have that it's unstained. I think it's like that. So sometimes they tend to interchange like that. But generally, in that case, it's bodhicitta. So that's the that's what Chenrei Sig rests on, that enlightened attitude. Okay, so we're actually out of time. And what I'd like you to do, we didn't get quite into the self-compassion, but we are. And I wanted to just mention, they have this book here that I co-authored. It's helpful. They just have excerpts from the course I taught. Some of you are familiar with this course. I think they do it here. They have a great program here. And in the back is the CD if you're interested. And this has an 11-hour course of me teaching an overview. So if you know some people newly interested to Buddhism, a lot of people found that quite helpful. And it's based in one of our wonderful prayers from Lama Tsongkhapa called The Foundation of All Good Qualities. And it takes you through the entire path of the Lamrim. Lamrim means stages of the path, so our underlying philosophy. Just as a summation of compassion of what we've covered so far, when we feel kind and compassionate towards someone, when we're connected with another's needs, another's pain, another's suffering, we feel most alive as human beings. Okay, we feel energized. Even our physical heart reacts with greater force. And Jinpa goes on, priming our body so it is ready to act. In the midst of compassion, in a sense, we're stripped of all the categories and labels that we've constructed about ourselves that individuate us from others. Okay, and our humanity is revealed. It's at this basic level we connect with the person in front of us. In that moment, what matters most is this person is another human being just like us who wants to be happy and who instinctively avoids suffering. Nothing else matters. Not their race, not their religion, not political affiliation or cultural affiliation, not their gender. To act from this place in response to the other person's need is to act out of true kindness. Out of true kindness. So just something to reflect on this evening. What I would like you to do as we start to move into self-compassion, I'll just give you a little heads up thing. Sorry, I've got a little bit of a mix of notes here. Okay, here we go. You're not, in self-compassion, you're not evaluating yourself according to worldly success. That's a tricky part. You're not evaluating yourself as far as worldly success. Okay, you're not comparing yourself. Okay, instead, you acknowledge your shortcomings and failings with patience, understanding, and kindness. It's a very different expanse of, right? You acknowledge your shortcomings your failures with patience, understanding, and kindness. You view your problems in the larger context of the shared human condition. So not like self-esteem, okay? Self-compassion lets you feel more connected with other people, more positively disposed toward them, because I'm aware of how I make mistakes. So once I see somebody else screwing up, I'm like, hey, I get it. I'm there with you, brother, right? We've all been there, and that kind of thing. If I'm just holding myself up to certain standards and haven't looked at that in myself, when I see somebody else make a mistake, you can tend to more harshly judge or pull away from them, not want to connect. Do you understand the difference? So as far as, so finally, self-compassion lets us be honest with ourselves. With its attitude of acceptance, self-compassion promotes a realistic understanding of our situation. If the results of preliminary studies are any indication, our capacity for self-compassion can also be quite flexible and things like that. You see people's a lot of lack of self-compassion, you know, which leads you to hatred and anger. That's where it goes. When they have a lack of self, it starts here. Your compassion externally starts here. But again, not in a selfish sense. I don't lose sight of my intention. But I realize if you don't have compassion here and start to understand your own suffering, how are you going to experience that in somebody else and really feel it? Otherwise, it's superficial. Self-caring, an expression of self-compassion, is an instinct that not just humans, but all sentient beings share. Everybody has some. So self-hatred is rooted in the very same self-caring instinct. Hatred is a form of caring, okay? We don't hate if we don't care, okay? Self-hatred comes from caring a lot, but being unable to accept or forgive our imperfect selves. So it's interesting of where, you know, I'm not able to accept this, I don't make these mistakes. You start hating yourself, then it's going to go out to others. So we'll talk more about that tomorrow afternoon. I think in the morning we might talk about forgiveness, if you're interested in that. It relates to this, but it's kind of a different topic. What I'd like you to do tonight, if you can you do some self-caring exercises, whatever you'd like to do? Whatever represents that to you, based on the little bit I've told you about, of whether it's reflection on your own stuff. And so based on that, you know, maybe I decide that I really need to be quiet tonight and take a bath. I mean, that can be a form of self, that can be the expression of self-caring. After I realize, like, this is going on and I'm thinking about these things and it's kind of poked a little delicate area in me and made something a little uncomfortable, I want to look at that. So maybe I won't, you know, just watch the movie tonight. I might do a little this, or I might read that book, or be quiet, or I might connect with a friend. Might decide to really connect with a friend. Make sense? Anyway, try your best. Okay? And I just like to, in closing, I'd like to read Master Shantideva's beautiful prayer. And it is on page 246 in the Gold Prayer Books. Let's send this out to the universe. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creatures suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power. May people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Thank you very much. I'll just leave some, if anybody needs a card, because I am leading, if you're interested, and this is on the East Coast, but it's in New York. Outside of New York, there's a beautiful old Christian monastery called Garrison Institute. So I'm leading a retreat hosted by Shanti Deva Meditation Center in New York, connected to us. It's a two-day retreat. It's our third year we do it. Anyone's welcome. We just sit. So I guide meditations. It's just a beautiful place. Wonderful. We always have a wonderful time there. If you're interested, it's on my website. And then there's a week-long retreat I'm leading at Vajrapani late April, but that would be California if you feel like having a holiday out there. And then there's other retreats and programs on the website you could check in with. And then there's the teachings connected to some teachings. Thank you so much for coming, and hope to see some of you tomorrow.
Thanks, everybody. Just wanted to have a few announcements. Thank you so much, Venerable Amy. This was an amazing part of the weekend. It's not over yet. So for those of you who are visiting, what's coming up next is tomorrow morning from 10:30. Well, we have our meditation, silent meditation in the morning from 9 to 10. The children's program and Venerable Amy from 10:30 to 12 to noon. So we talk about forgiveness. And
10:30.
Right.
I can sleep in.
Yes. 10:30. I'm sure she'll be up early doing her part of peace for the world. And then we'll have lunch wherever you're going. You can grab some people, go to lunch, and then come back at 1:30 to 4. It's to 4, right? Can somebody concur that that's correct? I think that's correct. And so the teachings will resume then, and we'll close down at 4. So I do want to just remind everybody to go to the website to look at all the offerings. Chris last night even put up, or this morning, I don't know when he put up, but this morning, last night's teachings were already up. So I was checking in a little bit to make sure what the homework was. So he's lickety-split on that. So you can check the teachings out. And since 2004, you can check the. So every visit you've had, yeah, it's really amazing. So they're all there for you, all the teachings. And then you know what's coming next. So everything we do here is donation only. Sometimes people hear that is free. It can be free to you if you want to donate just a good mind, if you want to donate mantras, if you want to donate helping to clean up. That's wonderful. And if you would all help maybe preparing the Gampa for tomorrow morning. We tend to think this is our camp, but we have everybody else coming in the morning, so tidy up. You can even reserve your spot. If you're attached to where you're sitting, just put a little marker there. Put your stuff there. That's fine. So if you wanted to, feel free to donate any monetary gifts. You may do so in the boxes that are out there, checks. We have new text giving, and Venerable Amy's got A, B, C, D. She's listed, and all, so you can pick from the drop-down menu. And then you can even go online to our new onrealm.org and donate that way. So if you think about being involved in a workshop like this, other people travel around the world and around the country to see this teacher. So she's right here, right in front of us, and sometimes we forget how lucky we are. I live 1 minute, so I just drive over here and go back home. Or I go to Vajrapani, which is like an event. And so I do want to put a plug in for that. It's an amazing place to be at Vajrapani. So thank you, guys, and enjoy the rest of your day.